Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Echo, Part 2, Chapter 13. Mr. Potter could make the harmonica sound like a train on a track, a baby crying, or rain falling in the wind. Sunday afternoon, Mike and Frankie sat on a bench under a shade tree next to the Potter's cottage, hypnotized by his playing. Mike couldn't take his eyes from Mr. Potter's hands or his mouth, and the way his head swayed with the music. He recognized familiar melodies, but they were peppered with repeating rhythms. The sound seemed to transport him to another place and time, someplace ancient and earthy. The beat started and stopped, questioned and answered. Mike had never heard anything like it before. When Mr. Potter paused, Mike asked, "What is that sound?" Mr. Potter nodded and grinned. "Kind of catches you, doesn't it? Called the blues." "Why?" asked Frankie. "Ever heard someone say they're feeling blue?" asked Mr. Potter. "Means sad, or they got the melancholies about life. So blues music is about all the trials and tribulations people got in their hearts from living. It's about what folks want but don't have. Blues is a song begging for its life."
"But the music doesn't sound sad all the time," said Mike.
"No, the songs are full of something else, too," said Mr. Potter. "That's the thing. No matter how much you don't have, there's always so much more of life to be had. So, no matter how much sadness is in a song, there's equal amount of maybe things will get better someday soon."
"Can you make any song the blues?" asked Mike.
"Not always. But you can make most sound bluesy."
Frankie laughed. "Bluesy? That's funny."
"Means you can give most any song the flavor of the blues."
Mr. Potter put his harmonica to his lips and played Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. It was the same melody their mom used to sing, but with repeating phrases. At the end, Mr. Potter seemed to goad the song into wailing.
"How did you do that?" asked Mike.
"Easy," Mr. Potter grinned. "You take the tune and break it up, then do over some of the lines, then sprinkle in some grit from your insides. You play the song like you're testifying to the feelings you hold in your heart. Happy, sad, angry. Mike, you follow what I do."
He played two chords. Mike repeated them. He played a note, bending it. Mike copied him. Mr. Potter made each phrase different from the last. Back and forth they went, first Mr. Potter and then Mike. Short notes like words, followed by longer phrases like full sentences. Then entire paragraphs of music, as if the two of them were having a conversation. When they were done, Frankie clapped.
"Now me," he said.
Mr. Potter started over, making the phrases simpler. After Frankie caught on, Mike joined in. In the shade of the tree, with the sounds of the three harmonicas talking to one another and all that had happened to them in the last few days, Mike dared to let another sliver of happiness creep into his heart. Mrs. Potter called to Frankie and Mike from the back door of the main house and waved them over. Frankie ran ahead. Mr. Potter pointed to Mike's harmonica.
"That is something special. Got a quality I never heard before."
Mike nodded. I feel different when I play it." Mr. Potter smiled.
"Sometimes an instrument does that to a person. Makes the world seem brighter with more possibilities."
Mike understood what he meant. He'd felt it. He held out the harmonica, pointing to the tiny scroll-like M on the pear wood edge that he'd noticed yesterday. "What's this mean, Mr. Potter?"
"I don't know. Never saw such a thing.
Frankie's have it?" Mike shook his head.
"No, I checked."
"Probably put there by its maker. That harmonica isn't the only thing special. You got a natural talent. Mrs. Potter told me about your piano playing. Now I know what she was going on about. Wait here."
Mr. Potter went into the cottage. A few minutes later, he came back and handed Mike a thick book of music with harmonica tabs.
"You can borrow this a while. It'll pique your interest just fine. You gonna come back tomorrow and jam with me some more?"
Mike nodded.
"Thank you, sir. Yes, sir."
Slowly, Mike made his way toward the house, playing the songs he'd just learned. When a movement caught his eye, he glanced up at a second-story window. Mrs. Sturbridge stood, watching him. But before he could raise his hand to wave, she disappeared, and the draperies plunged closed. He hadn't had an opportunity to apologize for playing the piano yesterday. Was she still upset about that? Or was it something else? Mrs. Sturbridge's strange behavior continued. For 2 weeks, they hardly saw her. Mrs. Potter kept them busy with a schedule of meals and playtime and chores. Mr. Potter let Frankie follow him around like a puppy. Mr. Howard came every few evenings and ate dinner with them, staying after to play catch on the lawn or a game of checkers on the porch. He took them to the park on the weekends. She never joined them. Mike tried to tell himself it didn't matter, that just being together was enough for him and Frankie. But he saw how the kids' eyes followed Mrs. Sturbridge when she whisked past them. He felt Frankie's longing to be part of a family again. And sometimes, in his heart of hearts, Mike even dared to wish the same for himself. He took comfort in the blues. He practiced as much as he could with Mr. Potter, working through the music book and making each song bluesy. Every time he played, he felt buoyed, lifted up, and full of possibility, as if he were riding on the shoulders of some unknown power. He could sense something optimistic in his heart, making his music shine from the inside out. In the hours between playing, though, he felt confused and unsettled. Something about being on Amaryllis Drive was rotten. The night before the 4th of July, Mike sat on his side of the bed, flipping through the pages of the book Mr. Potter had given him and studying the music. He started at the beginning with "Good Night, Ladies," followed by "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow," and "Oh, Susanna." Frankie came into the bedroom and climbed up next to him. "Play me a song, please." Mike obliged, easing into "My Old Kentucky Home." "That was good," said Frankie, his eyes already drooping. "Mike, do you think tomorrow..." His eyes closed and his forehead wrinkled as if he were wishing hard for something. Mike didn't need Frankie to finish the question. Every night he asked the same ones. "Do you think tomorrow she will spend time with us? Or maybe let us eat in the dining room with her instead of in the kitchen?" Mike reached over and smoothed Frankie's forehead. "Do you think she'll take us to see the fireworks at the park? 'Cause, you know, the 4th of July," Frankie murmured, "especially since Mr. Howard is out of town." "Sure, kid," whispered Mike. "Go to sleep now. Maybe tomorrow will be the day." Chapter 14. The 4th of July came and went without mention. The Saturday following, after breakfast, Mike sat in the bedroom playing the harmonica while he and Frankie waited for Mr. Howard to take them to the park. Frankie got up from the floor where he'd been pencil drawing and went to the mirror above the dresser. "Mike, do you think I need another haircut?" Mike stopped playing and studied Frankie. "Maybe in a few weeks, but you look fine for now." "Do you think I'm too noisy?" "Frankie, no. Why?" "'Cause everybody here likes us, except her. I've been leaving nosegays from the garden by her bedroom door and making pictures and leaving them at her place at the dining table, but she doesn't ever talk to us. So I was just thinking if Mr. Howard took me for a haircut or if I was quieter, then maybe..." He shrugged. "Listen, like I tell you every day, she's just getting used to us. She wasn't expecting boys or two of anything. And it takes some folks longer than others to warm up. At least we're not at Bishop's and we're together, right?" Frankie nodded. "Right. You know, sometimes I feel guilty we have so many nice things now when so many other kids don't have anything," said Mike. "You ever feel that way?" Frankie nodded. "I think about James and how he's still at Bishop's with shoes too small, and I have new ones." "Same here. I think about Mouse living on the streets and wonder what he's going to do when it gets cold. And here I
have a bed full of blankets. I think about these things a lot, about how come it was us and not someone else who got picked to come here. We're the lucky ones, kid.
Frankie gave him a wobbly smile. Mike wished he believed his own words, but even though they had so much, too many things still didn't add up. And even though Mrs. Potter had said Mike would get used to things not making sense, after 3 weeks he hadn't, and that worried him. There was something big gnawing at him, a question far more confounding than a piano in the music room that sorely needed playing. Mrs. Potter appeared in the doorway.
"Mr. Howard is here, Frankie. Let's get you cleaned up a bit."
"Is she coming with us?" asked Frankie. Mike looked at Mrs. Potter and caught the look of pity in her eyes and the almost imperceptible shake of her head. She put on a smile.
"Not today, but lots of vendors are still in the park. Being it's just after the holiday, you'll enjoy it."
She took Frankie's hand and led him from the room. Mike heard voices from the open window. He stepped closer. Down below, Mrs. Sturbridge and Mr. Howard stood on the front walk. She was dressed for town in her usual black, carrying gloves and a handbag. Mr. Howard had his hands on his hips.
"You're going to see the Golding today? Why don't you come with us?"
"I'm trying to undo what's been done."
"They're good boys, Uni, and talented. You'd see that if you gave them a chance."
Whatever Mrs. Sturbridge said next was so quiet that Mike couldn't hear, but her gaze dropped to the ground. Mr. Howard shook his head.
"I know you've suffered, Uni, but so have those boys. I'm sorry I put you in a situation that was far different from what you were expecting. I was doing my best, given that time was running out. You know, all your father ever wanted was for this house to be filled with children and music, and for you to open your heart again."
She looked up at Mr. Howard.
"What good has opening my heart ever done? Everyone who matters to me leaves me."
"That's not true. I never left you. Not on the playground when you were a girl and lost your mother. Not when you married a man your father didn't approve of. I stayed at your side when little Henry and your father..."
He choked up and his voice cracked.
"I never left through all of it. And I'm still here. But if this is your way of telling me that I don't matter to you, then maybe it's time I move on."
He turned and walked into the house. Her eyes followed him. She looked up and caught Mike watching her from the window. He felt the blood rush to his face. Would she be angry he was eavesdropping? She didn't look mad. She looked as if she might cry. Before he could blink, she spun around and strode to the Packard, where Mr. Potter held the door open. Mike watched the car pull away, more questions taunting him. What did her dead father have to do with their adoption? Who was Henry? And what was she trying to undo? Chapter 15. As they walked toward the park, Mr. Howard didn't talk or whistle, and the spring in his step was gone. When they passed his house, Frankie asked, "Have you ever climbed those trees?" Mr. Howard shook his head.
"Not since I was a boy. But you boys can climb them anytime you like."
"Mike won't ever, because he's afraid of heights."
"Is that true, Mike?"
Mike nodded.
"I'm afraid of spiders," said Frankie. "What are you afraid of, sir?"
"Frankie, these days I'm afraid of losing everything I ever cared about."
He looked from Frankie to Mike.
"And I'm afraid of losing the things I'm beginning to care about."
"Like us?" asked Frankie. Mr. Howard smiled but looked sad, too. Mike felt a pang in his heart.
"You see, I had hoped that one day Uni and I might..."
Mr. Howard frowned. "Get married?" asked Frankie. Mr. Howard blushed. Even his freckles looked brighter.
"You love her?" asked Frankie.
He flung out his hands. "It might not matter anymore. I have an opportunity with my firm to transfer to San Francisco at the end of the year. I haven't told them yes or no yet."
Frankie took his hand.
"Please don't go."
"I can't promise to stay," he said. "It depends on what happens here."
Mike puzzled. What needed to happen for Mr. Howard to stay? As they approached the park, Frankie ran ahead and joined some boys playing ball. Mike and Mr. Howard sat on a bench. What would become of them if Mr. Howard left? There'd be no more Saturday outings, no more playing ball on the lawn, no more checkers after dinner. Without him around, the house would seem bigger, their lives emptier, especially since Mrs. Sturbridge barely spoke to them. Mike took a deep breath, the big question burning in his stomach. He forced himself to ask it. "Mr. Howard, sir, how come Mrs. Sturbridge adopted us? We've hardly seen her since we got here. Even though we look presentable now, she still doesn't seem to want us." Mr. Howard took off his hat and stared at it as if it held all the answers. "I guess it must feel that way. I suppose you're old enough to understand and have a right to know. You see, Michael, you and Frankie are her father's final wish."
"You mean when he was dying?"
Mr. Howard leaned back.
"Not exactly. You see, when Uni was 20, she married a violinist she met in New York at a symphony benefit. He performed abroad for months at a time, so she lived in the big house with her father. Her husband came and went. A few years later, they had a son, Henry. That house became a different place with him toddling and then running around, so full of life and laughter and joy. He became the light of Uni's and her father's lives. She and Mr. Dow spoiled him a little too much."
"In the young gentleman's department?" remembered Mike.
"Where is Henry now?"
"Against her wishes, Uni's husband took him to a nearby lake one day. Henry was only 3 and couldn't swim. Her husband wasn't watching. He'd met some friends there and had his eyes on other things. And there was an accident, and Henry died."
Suddenly, everything became clear. Mike whispered, "That's why she didn't want to adopt a child, especially a boy."
Mr. Howard stared into the park. "She never forgave her husband. They stayed together for a few years, but he was rarely home, and soon he was squandering her money. They finally divorced. Then Uni shut out the world. She hardly ever left the house."
"She still had a father, though," said Mike.
"Yes, for 5 years. He was in a wheelchair by then. Polio. Taking care of him gave her some purpose. But as Mr. Dow grew frailer, he worried that Uni would never have a family. All he wanted was for her to feel joy and love again. Secretly, he changed his will so that she would inherit his wealth only if she started proceedings to adopt a child within 1 year of his death, preferably a child who was musical. Otherwise, everything would go to charity, including the house. Uni hadn't performed with an orchestra for years, so if she didn't oblige, she would have no income."
"Was she surprised?" asked Mike.
"That's putting it mildly. Angry, surprised, indignant, and sad that her father had died on top of it. At first, she said she wouldn't dishonor Henry's life by replacing him with another child. She tried to get the will changed, but her father was clever. It's almost ironclad. She put off adopting until the year deadline was only weeks away. That's when she sent me to choose a child for her, so she'd be within the law, to buy her more time."
Mr. Howard looked at Mike, apologetic.
"I thought our adoption was final."
"The papers have been filed, but they don't become legal until 3 months have passed. You were adopted the second week of June. The second week of September, it will be said and done."
Mike's stomach began to churn. So that's what she meant when she said, "I'm trying to undo what's been done." That's why they'd hardly seen her. She didn't want to spend any time with them. She was trying to get rid of them.
"Mike, are you all right?"
Mike said slowly, "So we were brought here so the lawyers could have an extra 3 months to figure out how she can un-adopt us." Mr. Howard nervously rotated his hat around and around.
"I'm sorry."
He put an arm on Mike's shoulder. Mike pulled away, choking out his words.
"How soon is she going to send us back?
Just tell me, Mr. Howard. I have to know.
Legally, she's only required to adopt one child. I suppose she could send you both back and start proceedings on another child. As long as the adoption process is underway, she meets the criteria. But that's not likely to happen.
Mike felt as if he'd been scrambling up a cliff, but just as he reached the top, he slipped and fell to the bottom.
So she could just keep adopting a different boy every 3 months until the waiting period is up? And make him think he's going to live in a beautiful house, have good things to eat, and get nice clothes, and spend time with you? And then, when he gets his hopes up that something right is finally happening in his life, she will send him back to Bishop's?
Mike, I don't think it will ever come to that.
Mike's mind raced, and his words tumbled.
I gotta look out for Frankie. Bishop's won't be taking any lowers come September, and he just can't go to the state home. Kids die there.
Mike clenched his fists.
Why did you choose us if you knew? Maybe another family would have come along. Maybe a family who cared about us would have...
He choked back, a lump in his throat.
Mike, listen to me. When I met you and Frankie, I knew immediately there was something special about you boys. I lost my own brother in the war, and I'd give anything to have him back. I couldn't separate you. That day at Bishop's, it became apparent that Mrs. Pennyweather intended to do just that. I figured if I brought you here, you and Frankie might be safely together for at least the summer, and hopefully longer.
Mike dropped his head.
I knew it was too good to be true.
Mr. Howard said quietly, It will all be good and true in the end. I'm hanging my hat on it. He blew out a long breath. You know, Mike, she wasn't always closed off and distant. Grief did that to her. She was such a loving mother, and when she was with Henry, her happiness just spilled over. She could be, can be, quite wonderful, and so talented. She was a concert pianist, you know. When she walked on stage, my heart and the whole world stood still. I admit that bringing you and Frankie here was a risk, but I still think it was the right thing. Can't we hope for the best?
How could Mike hope for the best when the worst seemed so much more probable? He didn't answer.
Mr. Howard sighed and patted Mike on the back.
I would adopt you myself if the law allowed a single man to do such a thing, but it doesn't.
He stood and walked to a vendor with a pushcart and came back with 3 Good Humor bars. He called to Frankie and waved him over. Frankie climbed up on the bench and grinned, his cheeks pink from playing.
Thank you, Mr. Howard.
He licked the dribbles from his ice cream bar as quickly as they melted. He looked up at Mike.
You're not eating. What's wrong?
Nothing, kid.
Mike wasn't going to fill Frankie's mind with the prospect of the state home. Besides, it was his job to worry. Frankie finished and begged Mr. Howard to push him on a swing. Mike stayed on the bench, staring at the Good Humor bar, watching the chocolate slide from the vanilla center. He held it over the grass as it fell apart, first the shell and then the insides.